Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller, and happy 4th of July. On this day when we celebrate independence and all of the higher ideals that America aspires to, we also have to acknowledge how our criminal justice and correction system fails so many Americans. Donna Hilden knows that better than many of us ever will. She went to jail and then prison at 19, adrift and alone, but for the 5-year-old daughter she was leaving behind, realizing that one terrible decision would completely change her life. And it did, but not in the way you might expect. Donna Hilden is a criminal justice reform activist. She's the author of a new memoir titled A Little Piece of Light. And she joins us this morning from New York. Donna, welcome. It's really good to have you here on the 4th of July. I know it's hot there. So thanks for hanging out with us before you go to the beach.
Thank you welcome. For inviting me. Thank you.
I think you're extraordinarily rare in that prison did completely change your life, but it changed your life in a way that gave you more purpose and confidence. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it did. It really did.
Tell me about how on that day that you were sentenced and expecting to spend 25 years in prison, what you thought your life was going to be.
So, you know, you never really know what you're going to feel or think, especially as a kid. I have to emphasize, I was very young. I was young emotionally and, you know, psychologically in a lot of ways. So I had... couldn't even understand how I had gotten to that point where I was being sentenced and convicted of kidnapping and murder, because I didn't kidnap anyone. I didn't murder them. And so it was hard. And so when I heard the judge, you know, the judge's sentencing, I didn't understand it. I wasn't even 25, so I couldn't understand 25 to life. It was not something that I could grasp in the moment, because I was still stuck on how did I get here. It just didn't hit me, the totality of it all. And it's really difficult to navigate as a young person, and a young person who's never been involved with any kind of the criminal justice system in any way, none of that. And then being alone through the process made it even harder for me, because I didn't have anyone there. And so it was a wealth of emotions, psychologically, emotionally, that was going on. I couldn't grasp that 25 to life. I really didn't.
You make a good point here. You did not have some lengthy juvenile justice record. You were not known to the correction system, which is pretty unusual for many people who end up in prison with the kind of sentence that you did at that age, isn't it?
Yes, it's absolutely incredible, because usually you see a pattern in someone's life, especially going through the things that I did. You know, children wind up in foster care system or, you know, some part of the system. And that didn't happen for me. That's not what happened for me. Maybe they would have been different if that did happen, you know, for me. Who knows? But that one mistake, like you said, that one, I said yes to something I should never have said yes to, and it was over. It was irreversible. And I didn't know that. I don't even think an adult who's a healthy adult understanding the world and people would have even been able to navigate their way out of that themselves.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that maybe if you had somehow ended up in the juvenile justice system, that might have been the catalyst. That, I mean, you know, we're accustomed to thinking of the juvenile justice system as this really broken, dysfunctional system, and nothing good ever happens for people there. But sometimes you wonder whether that might have been the moment that made you kind of wake up.
Yeah.
Why?
So the reason I say that, and let me be clear, any of these systems are really, they're not good. They're really violent. They're abnormal in a way that is so unexplainable to someone who has not lived the experience. And what I think that I'm saying, or what I think could have happened, is that I would have learned the system a little bit more. I had absolutely no clue, no idea. I have never been in front of, you know, a precinct, going through any kind of process, never been in front of the criminal court system, nothing like that. But when you're in juvenile detention, you do, you're faced with the system, so you kind of understand it a little bit better, maybe. But as a child also, and then as a very abused child, you know, it's hard to really know if that's also true. For me, not understanding the system at all from the point of arrest on, it played a lot into, like, the non-decisions that I made, right? Or not understanding what was going on and when I was going through court. I didn't understand that. I was intelligent as I was book-wise, was just as naive and really dumb as I was, you know.
The other thing that occurs to me as you're talking about this is you might have come in contact with an adult who would have intervened in these abusive situations that you were in as a young child in Jamaica, and when you got to the United States, you might have found somebody that you could have told what was happening.
It might have. I mean, like I said, now I've been through the system. I've been there so long. I've met people. I met some good people, you know. Well, I met some really bad people, but I also met some good people. You know, it's individual. And the system, to me, does not represent the person. And the person, in some ways, does not represent the system when they show themselves to be, you know, their humanity, when they show their humanity. And so for me, that's the difference. And I think that that could have happened. It might not have happened, but it might have. You know, I would not, I don't know. But I also had a mother figure who technically represented systems in her capacity, and she allowed things to happen to me. She allowed me to be raped. She allowed me to be abused. And she knew. I know she knew. Now as an adult, I know she knew. You know, so then that puts it in the question also, would I have gotten help?
Right.
You never know.
One of the things that you quickly realize when you get to the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility is that so many of the women there have been subject to the violence and the abuse that you experienced from parents and boyfriends and teachers and many of the men in their lives. And you write, "Our turmoils are varied but vivid, and each of us is a woman who has had to resort to extreme circumstances to try to save her own life." You also add that women were never really permitted to explain their own histories, describe their histories, and how that might have influenced their decision-making.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true even now. You know, we hear, Time's Up and Me Too, and that's great. It's time for women to be able to have a voice and to stand in our truth like I stand in my truth. Mm-hmm. But those movements and those conversations do not include women who are in the criminal, we call it criminal legal system, right? Women that are incarcerated and girls that are incarcerated still have not been able to speak for themselves and to be seen as who they are and what happened. We all are a story. Something's happened. You know, there's a root cause to everything. Something's happened to bring a person to a certain point. And we focus so much on the act that we totally negate the person, the human being. And that means even victims as well that in a crime. Like Mr. V in my crime, he wasn't a focus. It was a crime that was a focus. Mm-hmm. But he as an individual was not a focus. And I recognized that once I was starting to understand and to learn and to remember, you know. And so something's wrong. So if we start looking at people and listening and finding out, why does a girl run away at 14? Once I said that, that should have been like, well, wait a minute, why did she run away? You know what I mean? Kids don't just run away.
Do you think, Donna, that some of this is, I don't know, in some ways a protective measure that society indulges in, which is, there must be something bad about her. She ended up in prison. That's not a thing I have to worry about for my family. You say yes?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. We've got, you know, one thing about, you know, and I won't say that's everyone because I've met people that don't do that, but an overwhelming majority do that. Well, that's not me. It doesn't affect me or mine. And so that's them. It's that us and them, mm-hmm. them and us kind of separation. And we think that it doesn't affect us as a whole, as a race of human beings, but it does. It does, because it does something to the moral fabric of our existence. If we think that it's okay to neglect or to deny that pain and hurt and abuse and violence is happening to anyone, especially the most vulnerable, who are children, something is wrong. And even if it doesn't physically affect us, it's spiritually affecting us, psychologically affecting us, and emotionally affecting us. We can see it happening now. Look how we are so devoid of feeling. It's just this battle between, like, it's like good and evil. It makes, you know, it's hard. It's horrible.
Did you find, Donna, when you began hearing the stories of the women that you were serving in prison with, that many of them can trace abuse back to childhoods and can trace, you know, these patterns mm-hmm. of violence, that yeah. your stories have a real commonality around them? Is that true?
Absolutely true. And that was the thing, is, you know, when I went to prison, being a young woman, really basically adolescent still,
right.
I was faced with that. I saw, you know, when you go through abuse as a kid, you really feel like you're alone, right? And we have a way of adapting and trying to make it some normalcy out of it, even though it's so completely abnormal.
Right.
And so you think you're alone in that because you think you're some kind of monster. You believe every bad thing about yourself, and you own it. And so you don't see that there, you can't see anything else. And then when I got to prison and I started hearing the stories of these other young girls like myself and women who have been there sometimes, I was like, oh, my goodness. I was listening to them, and I was like, oh, my God, I'm not alone. And like I said in the book, in that moment, I was so happy. I was like, oh, my God, I'm not alone. I'm not just monster, this freak, this whatever. And then I started dawning on me, wait a minute, I'm not alone. And something just started opening up, and I was like, why am I not alone? Why so many, the overwhelming majority of the women that I was incarcerated with have the similar, I mean, the trajectory is the same. Abuse and violence and rape and all those things have permeated their entire lives.
And they also...
And something's wrong with that. Mm-hmm.
And they also, it sounds like, had a... I mean, many of the women that you spent time with, it sounds like, had the kind of self-identity that you did. I don't want us to miss this. You're saying mm-hmm. you felt responsible in some ways for the abuse and the violence
yes,
that
yes.
you'd experienced, and you
yes.
wondered, what is it about mm-hmm. me? And you had a very low, I guess,
self-esteem.
None.
I wasn't even low. I had none. I had lost my self-identity. It was never allowed to even form, basically. You know, in the formative years, right, a child, we have formative years. We go mm-hmm. through spurts, and so we become who we become if we're allowed to naturally, right, naturally and normally low. But that's not what happened for me, and that's not what happened for a whole lot of the women that I met. And so you don't know who you are because you were never allowed the opportunity to develop into who you could become. And that's why I said we're better than this. For the most part, and I'm not saying people are not born with this so-called deviant behavior or whatever, and most of the majority of that is mental health, right? And so there's treatment that's necessary. We should have some timeout spaces for people who basically fall under that category. But treatment is necessary for all of these things. But what we've been doing is incarcerating everything under the sun that we just don't want to be bothered with. But I have to say this for mm-hmm. listeners, and I say this when I'm out speaking, people need to understand the system, the prison system, is not designed to keep everyone in for their entire lives. Mm-hmm. It's not. 95% of people are coming home at some point.
And you talk about that because why?
Because we feel that, well, we lock them up and throw away the key, we never have to be bothered with uh-huh. them. That's not true. People come out at some point. I don't care if it's 30, 50 years later. Some people are coming out. It's only like 5%, 5% of the incarcerated population who are not coming out.
So what happens on the way in?
Right. So how do we treat people? And so, you know, my advocacy, my activism is not saying that I reopen up the prison gates and everybody just rushes out. No, I'm saying people do need time because we need to be responsible and accountable for the act, right? The behavior, whatever that may be. But how do we treat people? How we treat people is the biggest concern for me. If you treat them like, it could have been opposite for me. I could have been, the treatment that I've gotten, the abnormalities that are in prison itself is abnormal, mm-hmm. right? It's anti to anything that our humanity represents. And so if I would have fed into that piece and fed into the violence and fed into all that stuff, I could have come out a worse person.
You could have come out very warped instead of purposeful,
warped.
Right?
Exactly. But if we treat people like human beings, we look at these countries, Finland, Norway, and all these others, and treat people like human beings so they recognize their humanity. Once you start tapping into that, you are able to recognize your part into things, how you contributed into hurting people or person and self. We need to understand that. You don't learn anything from being treated violently or horribly. You don't learn anything. And so people come out and they're probably worse than they would ever have been. You know what I mean? But we don't think that way. We think that this is this quick fix, that incarceration is this quick fix. Yes, we're going to lock them up. We're never going to see them again. That's them, not us, and move on with our lives. Absolutely not.
A conversation on this 4th of July with Donna Hilton. If you've tuned in, it's a discussion about her memoir and some of the larger ideals and commitments that she emerged from more than two decades in prison with. She's become a criminal justice activist. Her memoir is the story of growing up first in Jamaica and then in New York, her participation in a crime that ended up sending her to prison, to the New Bedford, the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women for more than 20 years. Her experience there, her realization that there could be purpose in her life, coming out of prison, writing the story, and being committed to being an activist around some of these criminal justice issues. If you'd like to join the conversation, maybe this is a discussion within your family because somebody has spent time in prison, someone struggling to get on their feet after coming out of prison. What has prison meant for that member of your family or that good friend of yours? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Donna's memoir is called A Little Piece of Light, A Memoir of Hope, Prison, and A Life Unbound. Donna, I know people who are listening will naturally have some curiosity about the crime and hearing you say, I didn't realize what was happening might be confusing until we describe it. You got swept into a plan to kidnap someone and basically extort money from him. But it seems clear to me in reading the memoir that you were in kind of a daze of denial over what you were really participating in. Is that fair to say?
Well, it wasn't even so much I was in denial. What I did do, and I take full responsibility, was when I said, okay, I agreed to witness a blackmail scheme, right? Because whatever the reason is, and that reason isn't even important, I agreed to it. And that was my error.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was going, I was planned to win, to go, to witness this intimate scene, so it could be, the victim who I didn't know anything about him. These were adults doing adult things and businesses that I had no idea about.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to get some money because I wanted to create a livelihood for myself and my daughter, and I was still a kid, and no one was helping me. So I agreed to something. I agreed to a blackmail scheme. Mm-hmm. And then when I went, it had already turned into, it was a kidnapping. I walked into a kidnapping. And the moment I walked into that, it was over.
Where they were holding a man you referred to as Mr. V,
Well, that's his Mr. V. I shorten his name, Vigliarolo, because it's a very long tongue twister, so I call him Mr. V. That's my intimate name. I just call him Mr. V. Yes.
And he was being held in this place by this group of people, and you were in contact with him while he was being held, right? You were bringing him water sometimes and saying, hey, we have to feed him.
When I was in the place, in the apartment that he was being held, yes, sometimes I would like, well, did he drink? Like, you know, because I'm thinking, I'm like, wait a minute, does anyone feed him? What, you know, I argued for that. Like, I really, like, fought for that. And, you know, I got hit for it. But I felt like that was the only thing I could do. I felt helpless. I felt hopeless and helpless. I didn't know how did this happen, right? I didn't see the bigger picture because it was not my plan. It wasn't my scheme. It wasn't any of that. I take full responsibility, though, for saying that, yes, I would witness a blackmail scheme. Take full responsibility. And then, again, when I got you the designated place, the apartment, to witness this scene, intimate scene, Mr. V was already kidnapped. And then I turned into a victim myself. A gun was pulled. I was told I had to drive a car. I had to do whatever was said. My daughter's life was in danger, even my adoptive parents' life. And I didn't want anyone hurt. I basically disassociated as I did with any other form of abuse that's ever happened because I walked into an abusive situation.
Yeah, you removed yourself psychologically. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you described that because that is what comes through in your description of your involvement is you're just, you know, you're removed. You're in kind of a daze of I'm not really participating in this, but I'm watching it unfold. Let me take a call here from Michael in St. Paul. Hi, Michael. It sounds like you've had some experience with the correction system. Yes?
That is correct. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Glad you called.
All right. Thank you. I just wanted to say that I am totally in agreement with this woman. I forget her name now, but
Donna.
There needs to be something done with prison reform in America. It's at a point now that's becoming a serious issue. We incarcerate people more in America than any other country in the world, more than the Soviet Union or Communist China. It's crazy how she's very on point with the fact that people just lock them up. They want to lock them up and then forget about them. And yet there isn't a whole lot done to correct the problem. And another point I wanted to make is that I think that in America we're focusing on the wrong types of people we're sending to prison, people that need help, like in particular drug offenders who are more locked up in America than rapists are. So there's these people that are out there committing heinous crimes against women mostly, but other men get raped too. And it seems like it's overlooked. I just saw a show.
Michael, if I might, there's other people on the line, but I do want to come back to what you said about the drug offender situation because, Donna, I suspect that you had some contact and what probably friendships with women that were in prison for drug offenses.
Yes. Well, I have a conversation about that. I want us to be clear that we don't keep dividing people into categories.
And what do you mean by that when you say that?
Well, a lot of the argument, well, not a lot, but some people's arguments is that, oh, we should focus. And I think to Michael's point, if I may, is saying that they're low level drug offenses and we lock them up. Right.
Right.
And it's true. It's true. People do things majority of the times because they're trying to feed themselves and or their families and trying to survive. And so when you are in a poverty situation, basically, poverty is violence. And so people react. We have basic necessities, needs. And so we want to eat, we need to sleep, we need all these things. And we try to figure that out. And so a lot of communities don't have the resources and opportunities that some do. And so people do whatever it is they need to survive. And so we lock the responses up, right? We lock up drug addiction. We lock up drug sales. We lock those things up. But people also do horrible things in moments because for the very same reason. And so, again, we don't look at the root causes of why a person does something or gets involved into something. We don't look at it. And if we continue to separate, One of the hardest things for me, and I put it in the book, what I thought, I had forgiven everyone that ever did anything to me. And then I was put into a position, employment position, where I was working at a shelter. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the men there were sexual offenders, mm-hmm. sex offenders. And I thought I would never, like, I was like, oh, my God, I don't think I really, moved on from that. And then I worked. I was like, face it. And then I started listening to those men. Quite a few of them should never have been labeled sex offenders. And I'm saying this as a survivor, mm-hmm. right? But some did. But then I heard them, and I realized that hurt and pain happened to them, and they just continued the behavior because they never got the intervention, the help that they needed. And I'm not saying what they did was right, but I'm saying what we do or don't do contributes to it.
I think I also hear you saying, beware of the pat on the back that
yes.
says, we're yes. doing something for low-level drug offenders. You know, case closed. We figured this out.
Right. But that's not going to solve our problem. The yeah. vast majority of people incarcerated in all our prisons and jails across the world, across the nation, are in there for violent crimes. The vast majority of prisons and jails are filled with people with violent offenses or alleged violent offenses. It's not drugs. It's not poverty crime. It's not none of those. It's violent crime. That's who fills up our prisons and jails. And so we need to look at that. We need to understand.
Donna Hilton is with us. If you've tuned in on this 4th of July, we're talking about her new memoir, A Little Piece of Light, a memoir of hope, prison, and a life unbound, but also delving into some of the pretty thorny questions around criminal justice. I opened the show by saying, of all the higher ideals that America aspires to, and we tend to think about that on a day like the 4th of July, we have to say how many Americans our criminal justice system fails. And Donna is an example of that, but also someone who came out of prison with a new purpose. And that's what we're talking about this morning. To join our conversation, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. If you're hanging out on social media, you can get to me on Twitter. It's at Carrie, KerriMPR. We'll get a look at the latest news with John Wanamaker. Hi, John.
Hi, Carrie. A senior Trump administration official says one day before President Trump remarked publicly about a military option to remove Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from power, he stunned top aides at an Oval Office meeting in August 2017 when he suggested invading the troubled country. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, says then National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and others took turns explaining how military action could backfire. However, they say Trump pushed back. The Thai soccer teammates stranded more than a week in a partly flooded cave say in a new video that they are healthy. Heavy rains, though, are forecast for later this week, which could complicate plans to safely extract them. Crews have been using pumps to remove water from that cave, and there are suggestions that the boys might have to learn diving to find their way out. The Trump administration is rescinding Obama-era guidance meant to promote diversity among students. The Trump administration says the government would no longer encourage schools to use race as a factor in the admissions process. Attorney General Jeff Sessions calls the changes an effort to restore, quote, the rule of law. Some universities say they intend to continue their diversity efforts as before. Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky has expressed reservations about one of President Trump's potential Supreme Court candidates. Paul had objections over Brett Kavanaugh, who conservative groups see as a top contender for the high court seat, but there are activists warning that he is too much of an establishment-aligned choice. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Jimmy Carter is 93 and still going strong. 3 years ago, he faced a deadly diagnosis and started saying his goodbyes. Months later, after treatment, he announced that he was cancer-free, opening a new chapter for America's 39th president. Jimmy Carter, next time on 1A.
1A is coming up at 10 a.m. on NPR News. We had a spirited and civil conversation yesterday morning about abortion, how activists are making strides in state capitals, what the vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court is going to mean. You can find it on the podcast. If you missed the show, only caught a part of it, search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you listen to podcasts. Back to our conversation now with Donna Hilton about her new memoir, A Little Piece of Light. Donna, I want to say that you went to a correction facility where there were a lot of high-profile women who'd been sentenced to prison, including Jean Harris, right, who was convicted in the death of the cardiologist who authored the Scarsdale Diet, and a woman named Betty Gal Tyson, who became a pretty tell me about her and why she became so important to you.
Betty Gale?
Yeah.
So Betty Gale Tyson, she was one of the most maternal, nurturing figures that I had encountered when I got there. She was very embracing, was just embracing and just very heartwarming. Her smile just made you say, it just was warm. You have to be around people that just have that way about them that you just feel like, oh, wow, I could just be around this person all day because they're just so, just their nature is loving, just by nature. It's very loving and nurturing. And so she was that for me. And I was a little, I was young and I was afraid. And I just, all I knew about prison was what I saw on TV. I never had any experience at all. And, she saw that, I believe. She saw that. And she just enveloped me into her presence, into her everything. And that was, it meant a lot to me at the time that I needed it. Because I didn't have that mother figure who was my adoptive mother, who's never been a mother to me, was nowhere around. So, and I couldn't even call or write and, you know.
And so she became a mother figure to you.
Absolutely. Oh. And also, Betty Gale was there before I got there. She was there 1978. I'm trying to remember my memory sometimes. Mm-hmm. So she's been there. She was there for a long time already. And she had a case where she kept saying that she was innocent. She was innocent. She was innocent. She actually was innocent, and she was proven innocent. And about 25 years later, when her sentence was up for her to go to the parole board, her case was sent back to court, and she was freed because the evidence showed that it was not her. And she was accused based on her profession. She was a prostitute,
right?
And because her being a prostitute, she was automatically, you know, convicted based on that. And she must have, you know, killed the man that, she was the first, and she, her case was big. And actually she was the first woman, longest serving woman who spent time in prison for being actually innocent in New York State.
Wow.
And she was awarded monies. She just happened to be a black woman. And so her case was, you know, it made you think like, oh my God, how many other women, you know, to her in prison who saying they're innocent, but based on whatever, you know, they've been convicted, accused. And so, yeah, it was just, I'll never forget that. You know, she brought hope to a lot of people.
I have your book open to a page where you describe the day you were released from prison. And
yes.
I just wanted to read a couple paragraphs if you're okay with that.
Yeah, I'm fine.
As you're getting ready to leave, one of the guards tells you that there's a partial lockdown because they're worried that there's going to be a rush of women who want to see you off. And you write, as the front gate reception area, I accept a small package. In this moment, my past meets my present as I discover what it holds, a tiny pair of earrings and a watch that my captain friend from Rikers gave me before I arrived at Bedford. In one way, time stopped for me when I came in here, and yet so much in my life has changed. These two tiny belongings have been kept safely for me since I arrived at Bedford. After I sign my discharge papers, an armed guard buzzes open a steel electric door. As morning light from the bright winter day breaks its way inside, I step forward into the light of day, into a free world that I don't know anymore. Among feelings of exhilaration, sadness, bewilderment, hope, and uncertainty, I drop to my knees. Thank you, God. Thank you. When I look up, a figure I know well stands before me. In front of a small sedan with a smile on her face is Mother. She's come to pick up her girl and take me home. And that's Betty?
No, that's actually Sister Mary.
Ah, Sister Mary.
Yes, Sister Mary, yes. This book is dedicated to her. She was the most loving individual I've ever. She was even more loving than Betty Gale. she, if you can imagine Jesus Christ living in this moment, she exemplifies that. She, unconditional love, is and was her. She's amazing.
And she meant a lot to you and still does.
I love that woman. Yeah, I have tears in my eyes talking. Yeah.
Let me take a call here from Matt in Maple Grove. Hi, Matt. Thanks for waiting.
Hey. Hi. Thanks so much for having me on the show. I have a quick question, and I'm calling from a point of view of somebody who's never been involved with the prison system.
Okay.
But somebody who has been presented with the opportunity to break the law and potentially go to prison. And I think a lot of us have, if not all of us. So I'm just kind of curious, why do people care? So when someone goes to prison, it almost seems like we as a society strip them of their humanity because they were unable to make the smart decision. For example, getting involved in a kidnapping situation. Rather, most people would probably have made the decision to not have gotten into that situation to begin with. So I feel like the 90% of us that aren't involved in the prison system or don't have family in the prison system will say, well, you know, that was not a smart decision. And we just don't care about you. So you can go and rot in prison. So what are we trying to do now? And it seems like prison reform has kind of been a topic over the last 20 years. Why now?
Yeah.
And what are we going to do about it?
Matt, I think your question is well taken because, and Donna, we skirted around this a little bit. It's like, well, why should people care? Because you and I talked about this feeling like, well, I'd never be in that situation. So I made the right choice. I mean, what's the answer back to this is something that is intrinsic to the idea of what it means to be an American?
Right. So I think I was trying to get to that response. And thank you for that, because those are those hard moments, right? These hard questions that are necessary for us to move forward as humanity. First of all, a lot of people like myself, the choices that we have in front of us are not the choices that everyone has. There are people, like I said, poverty plays a lot into this, and lack of resources and opportunity plays a lot into the decision-making of people. And exposure. And so people are in a situations where the options around them, one is not any different or better than the other. And that doesn't mean that it's right or wrong. It just means that those decisions or opportunities are not better than the other. And so they can put us on a trajectory to incarceration because it's out of need, it's out of desperation, it's out of quite a few things. And so there are other people that don't have those same situations. And so the opportunities and resources that they have available are fine. But we can't see that for someone else because we're so in our own world. Sometimes we have to step outside of it, and that's when I talk about exposure. Understand what's going on in those areas in our country that people don't have even lights that light their streets. We don't have paved and well-kept play areas for children, if there are any play areas for children. And opportunities for day programs, camp programs. And I'm not saying these are excuses, but I'm saying this is usually what pushes people to certain points. For me, I heard you say how, you know, about just saying okay to a kidnapping. If you listened, I didn't say I got involved with a kidnapping. I said that I made the wrong choice of saying, yes, I would witness a blackmail scheme. So it was a blackmail scheme. And that's what I had said okay to, and I was wrong, absolutely wrong. But everything around me was so abnormal that I didn't see how wrong that was, because in it was I was thinking there was a way out of the situation that I was in as a young girl trying to raise a daughter, and I was a kid myself, and I had a daughter who was a product of rape. And no one was helping me. All the adult figures that represented any system had basically not just abandoned me, but just abused me themselves. And so I was trying to figure it out. And that's what happened, and I'm recognizing a lot, especially for women. And I'm really talking about women. We are, those of us who are not given the opportunity to have any clear and normal choices or opportunities. And that does happen. We don't like to talk about it, but it does happen. And it happens a lot. It happens a lot. And so oftentimes a person is not just trying, is not saying, oh, I'm going to get up today and I'm going to go get involved in a crime where I kidnap and I murder someone. No, something's happened before that that leads up to that.
Which again, I want to make sure our listeners who are getting in on this at the end don't think they hear you saying, and all should be forgiven. No, you are talking
That's
about
not what
accountability.
I'm saying, right? Absolutely. I take accountability. You know, those are things that have been thrown at me. Oh, when is she going to take responsibility? Obviously, I have. That's why I'm doing this work.
And 20-something years in prison, right?
27, almost 20. Yeah, it's 27. I mean, it's just a couple of months short. And again, people are not spending their entire lives in prison. And I think that's what I'm hearing in there. Like, you think that a person that you lock all these people up and they're gone forever. No, they're not. There are much more people around you that have had some involvement with the criminal justice system than you would have ever imagined. We have 70 million people in this country who have been affected by the criminal justice system in some way or another. But you wouldn't know because a lot of people don't talk about it. But they're there. And what we hear are the stories of the least amount of people who do actually do things that are abnormal, that are wrong, but need to be addressed.
Donna, we've mentioned your daughter a couple of times. She was 5, right, when you went into prison?
4.
4, okay. And 4. You saw her while you were incarcerated.
Not really.
She wasn't, didn't.
Yeah.
Alvin
was very,
brought her
yeah,
to, yes.
Yeah, like 3 times. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I wondered how you've talked about this with Adrienne.
So now that she's a grown woman, mm-hmm. It's a work in progress, our relationship, but we both know we love each other. She still has this abandonment and just anger because I wasn't there. And she was also abused badly, horribly abused as a little girl by a family member. And that plays a lot, into her growth and in her psyche because mm-hmm. it was very horrible. It was horrible. We talk about those things. We're a work in progress, but we're better today than we were yesterday. And it's difficult. One of the most difficult things it is for a mother being ripped away from her child and the child being ripped away from the mother. And that's why we have this argument now about ripping families away at the border, which people think it's fine, but it's horrible. Again, the fabric of our humanity, our moral fiber is in a very dark place.
I want to take a call here from Anita in Brainerd. Hi, Anita. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make a point about children who are exposed to severe trauma and how this impacts the wiring of their brain. And they don't make the right decisions often as they get older, because of the way their brains have been impacted by trauma. And we know that there is talk about the pipeline to prison for children in foster care.
Right.
And those are children who've been severely traumatized, removed from their families, removed mm-hmm. from everything that they know, or they've been victims of abuse and neglect. And their brains are impacted. And so they don't think the way that other people, someone was talking about choosing to participate in a kidnapping. It's because of the damage that has been done to their brains, the circuitry mm-hmm. in their brains. I've worked for the past 20 years with kids in foster care. And I can tell you, trauma makes a severe impact mm-hmm. on the way that they think. And you mm-hmm. have to treat that trauma and help them get over that trauma, or they keep making those same mistakes over and over because of their brain circuitry.
Anita, I wonder if you think that is well understood in the courtrooms, you know, in which you're appearing for these foster kids.
Well, I don't think it is well understood, and I think it is a growing movement. If you look up trauma-informed care, there are people who are doing research and talking about this, but it needs to be much more widely acknowledged that people are not exercising. You may think they're exercising free will, but right. they've actually experienced brain damage.
I really appreciate your call. Grateful for it. Donna, this is why I was happy that you were available today, and I really wanted to talk to you about the memoir. I mean, you're kind of an example of what Anita is saying. You talked about that disassociation. You talked about the long scars, right, that last well into adulthood from this for
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely, yes.
I noticed that you were on a list and then taken off of a list for a sentencing reform meeting. I'm really not so much interested in what happened with Trump and Jared Kushner. Here's my question for you, though. I mean, do you have a sense that there is, if not on the part of the president, but on the part of Jared Kushner, there is a true commitment to keeping this momentum on sentencing reform going that was started during the Obama administration? What's your view of that?
I do believe that there is a commitment from Jared, and I think, and he says it, so I guess we can say it's clear that his commitment is because of his father spending time incarcerated. So he has some kind of an understanding. He's directly impacted by incarceration. My concern is, and it has to be a concern because we need to understand, we keep separating and dividing people into categories, low-level offenders, high-level offenders, this one and that one. And that's my concern, that the First Step Act and the prison reform that they are focusing on will leave out and continue to leave out people who are inside for violent crimes and then tell society that, oh, we've solved the problem.
Right.
Look, we've reformed. We've done this. We've done that. And to Mary's point, no, you have not, because, again, the vast majority of people incarcerated are in poor violent offenses. Whether they actually committed it or just accessories like I would, it doesn't matter. They're there, right? And so we have to look, we should look at everyone, all of it. Reforming anything means we have to go back to the beginning and see what we did or didn't do and how we can address it or what's going on, what it looks like now. We have to put all those things together.
Is your focus more on sentencing reform, or is your focus on, you know, prison reform, right?
Right.
Opportunity.
Yeah,
yes.
Prison reform. Prison reform, just in a nutshell, prison reform is making prisons in a whole somewhat better.
Right.
We're putting them up, right? We're saying, oh, well, look, there's opportunities in prison. You can come to prison and learn a trade, right? That's prison reform. Sentencing reform focuses on the sentencing of a person. Where's that argument is to look at the person, look at the trajectory, look at the story that is the person, not just the act. That's included. But look at the person and see, how did they get here? What happened? And so that would say, okay, well, this person, like a lot of the women who are in there because they were able to, and I hate to say it like this, but it just really literally killed the abuser before the abuser actually killed them in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
by happenstance, not because if they really wanted to, right? But then why do we continue to incarcerate and to continue to put that woman or even men, they go through the same thing, in that kind of condition without treating, to Mary's point, treating the trauma that has happened?
Okay, so
both things could be true.
So that's, is your work mostly focused on what happens once you get into prison, or is it mostly focused on sentencing reform?
My work is focused on all its criminal justice reform.
Okay.
That's the umbrella. Because I've lived through every stage of it and understand it from my lived experience, I speak on all of it because one precipitates the other or vice versa. You understand what I'm saying? So
yes.
I focus on it as a whole. So I can go into any area, and if you want me to talk about prison reform, I can talk about that, what that would look like for me, right? What would, for as a person who's been 27 years in prison, what it would look like.
I have just 2 minutes, but I'd like to hear what your primary reform inside prison would be.
Well, my primary reform in prison would be that a person is not, it's not just about punitive rehabilitation, because mm-hmm. you can't, the two, it's oxymoronic to say we are being rehabilitated as we are being punished. The two don't go together. So are we going to focus on the root causes of why people are in prison in the first place, like mental health? We have locked up the majority of people inside have mental health conditions or mm-hmm. issues. There's no focus on mental health in prison. So are we going to have a focus that deals with that a person can go through healing, they can have the therapy that's necessary, the medications that are sometimes necessary, not oftentimes, because I would like to say this, that people don't know, people are overly medicated and quickly diagnosed in prison for symptoms or issues that are not true, and then they're overly medicated based on whatever determination.
Donna, I wish you much luck with the work, and
thank
it
you.
Sounds like a lot of work ahead, but nice to know that you're committed to it. Thanks
thank
for being
you.
With us on the 4th.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Donna Hilton's book is called A Little Piece of Light, A Memoir of Hope, Prison, and A Life Unbound.